We'll call the Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development to order. This is March 28, 2011. Welcome, everybody. We've got a full agenda today. I will announce that we have one item that was set for work session, Senate Bill 438, that we will be carrying over. We will not be working it today. First thing, we have introduction of a bill draft. This is a courtesy that committees do. For those who are not familiar with our procedures, just to get it into the process, it doesn't commit the members in any way. So, having said that, the chair would move introduction of legislative draft 4003. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? The bill is introduced. Next up, let's see, Senator Whitsitt, I seen you there. We will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 581. Senator Whitsitt. While he's coming up, Richard, would you like to introduce the bill?
Sure. 581 creates an alternative contracting review board and provides board membership duties and functions. There's no revenue impact, but we have not yet received a fiscal impact statement on this.
Thank you. Senator, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, committee members. I thank you for accommodating my schedule this afternoon. For the record, I'm Doug Whitsett. I represent Senate District 28. Also, for the record, I am just a retired country vet, and I recognize that I'm way out of my expertise in introducing this bill. Having said that, ORS 279C provides that all public improvement contracts shall be based on a competitive bid. The law has two primary purposes. The first purpose is to obtain the lowest cost for the construction projects that meets the qualifications of the project. In other words, to get the best bang for the taxpayer's buck. The second purpose is to provide a fair and equitable opportunity for Oregon contractors to do business with Oregon public entities. Again, to create a level playing field. ORS 279.335 provides what is meant to be a narrow exception to the competitive bid requirement. An exception can be made when it is unlikely that the exception will encourage favoritism and that substantial cost savings will result. Or as an alternative, the contracting agency may identify the project as a pilot project for determination of alternative contracting methods. It is my understanding that these no-bid GMGC contracts are supposed to be used when certain expertise may be required that only certain contractors may have that expertise. For instance, it is arguable that there are few contractors that really have the expertise to remodel this building. You had to find somebody that had experience in removing marble without damaging it, transporting it, storing it, transporting it back to the Capitol, and then putting it back in that same mosaic jigsaw puzzle that they took it down in the exact same place. Probably not too many people, not too many organizations have that expertise. Further, the remodel had to be accomplished while the building was being occupied by 90 narcissistic legislators. The contractor necessarily needed experience in taking apart the marble jigsaw, the whole deal. That would not a GMGC contract makes sense in that situation. The problem is that the narrow exception is now being used to let the preponderance of contracts for the construction of public facilities in Oregon. The exception has become the rule. The result is that taxpayers are often not getting the best bang for their buck, and the process for letting contracts is no longer fair and equitable. For instance, small companies, companies owned by women, and companies owned by minorities have virtually no prayer of successfully competing for most of these contracts. Just no possibility. It is my understanding that many public entities simply use boilerplate language to assume that the GMGC contract will save the taxpayer money. Further, the public entity wordsmiths the contract so that only certain contracted companies are eligible. The public entity knows exactly who they want to perform the work, and they then write a contract to ensure that the contractor and no other contractor can qualify. We're aware of several bills currently in play to address this issue in this legislative session. This bill addresses the issue prospectively, attempting to make certain that Oregon contracting is cost-effective, fair, and equitable before the contracts are issued. Another bill, I think you're on the same agenda today, is Senate Bill 772, is retrospective in nature, requiring random audits to determine the contracts were appropriate to that, really reviewing the contracts after the fact. Another alternative might be to wordsmith the current statutes to effectively close this gigantic loophole. I spent some time reading through 279A and 279B and 279C. Mr. Chair, I simply ran out of little arrows and sticky faces. To follow the bouncing ball through that morass is virtually impossible. And what I came away with is that the contracting agencies can make it be just about anything they want it to be by putting together this and this and this. So I don't pretend to know what the best solution is. I am convinced that a significant problem exists that needs to be resolved by this legislature. I thank you for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Questions for Senator Whitsitt?
Thank you very much.
Thank you,
let's get back to work.
Thank you.
I'm going to recess temporarily on Senate Bill 581 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 485. Senator Bonamici.
Thank you very much, Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Atkinson, committee members. I'm Senator Suzanne Bonamici, and I represent Senate District 17 in the Oregon Senate. And thank you so much for scheduling this bill for a hearing today. I did submit some brief written testimony, but I won't read that for you. I'll tell you how this issue came to my attention. I have some constituents, Lynn and John Putnam, who are very sorry they can't be here today, but they emailed me quite a while back and asked if there's anything I could do to help with a situation that they were experiencing. They live in the district I represent, but they own rental property in Bend. And they had hired a property management company in Bend to manage that property for them. One day, they found out that the phone was disconnected, email was bouncing back, and they could not get in touch with the person who was the property management company. They ended up losing about $3,400 because they found out that the owner had embezzled funds. They wanted to know what could be done to prevent that in the future. So I contacted Commissioner Bentley from the real estate agency and asked if there were some tools that perhaps would be helpful for them to have that they did not have. It turns out that for at least a period of time in this particular circumstance that my constituents experienced, the company was operating without anyone on staff with the appropriate license. So the real estate agency said that they don't currently have the ability to seek a cease and desist order. That seems like a pretty important tool so that they could go in early when they expect that have evidence that someone is operating without a license and stop further damage. So hopefully with this bill, Mr. Chair and committee members, that a similar thing won't happen to others in the community. I did check with the realtors, and I know Sean Jillians is here. Hopefully, I believe he signed up on the bill, and hopefully this will prevent this type of problem from happening in the future. And I, again, thank you for hearing this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions for you.
I'm surprised they have to file that in the county office and lien records.
That's my understanding is the appropriate way to do that.
Huh.
Perhaps
okay.
Commissioner Bentley
questions
can explain that.
Senator.
And I know the Department of Justice is here as well.
Questions of Senator?
Strange.
Doesn't look like it. Thank you,
Thank
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, let's get back to work. And let's see. I have... What are we going to hear from the Mr. Duvanovich, first key.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chair Atkinson, my name is Keith Dubanovich. I'm Chief of Staff to Attorney General Kroger. Senate Bill 485 is a very narrow and specific bill, and what it does, as the Senator just said, It simply gives the real estate agency the ability to issue a cease and desist order. Unfortunately, it does not presently have that ability, and in essence, what happened, as Senator described, there were some people that were operating a real estate agency that was essentially acting as an escrow agent without a proper license. Unfortunately, the real estate agency was unable to stop them from continuing to do anything other than issue a fine. And what this bill does is simply give the agency the ability to issue a cease and desist order. As Senator Beyer has pointed out, the cease and desist order can be filed among the lien records. Doesn't have to be, but it can be, and the rationale for that is so that it's readily available and known to the public. Since we're dealing with real estate and real estate management type companies, it's the place that people would go to determine whether a company is under some sort of cease and desist order. You could either go to the real estate agency, they'd likely post it on their website, or you go to the county property records. We think it's a smart bill, and it certainly fills a gap in current law, and we therefore speak in support of the legislation.
Thank you, Keith. Any questions, Mr. Dubanovich?
Got off easy today.
Thank you
very much. Gene Bentley?
Thank you, Chair Beyer, committee members. For the record, my name is Gene Bentley, Real Estate Commissioner for the State of Oregon. As you've heard, we do not currently have the ability to issue a cease and desist order or to go to a court and get an injunction to prevent unlicensed real estate activity. The agency is in support of this bill and has found that also there are a number of other regulatory agencies that already have this authority. As an example, accountants, electricians, plumbers, tax preparers, mortgage bankers, security brokers, just to name a few. In this particular case, if we had had the ability to issue a cease and desist order, we could have issued that cease and desist order along with a civil penalty to prevent further activity. In the particular case that Senator Bonamici spoke of, we had initially issued a civil penalty. We went back and did a follow-up a couple months later, found that the individual was continuing to do unlicensed activity. They ended up embezzling some $235,000 from their clients. When we initially had found them, they had embezzled about $195,000. So if we could have issued the cease and desist order and got them to stop, we could have at least saved $40,000. The agency is supportive of this. I have been out speaking since September when we developed the initial concept, and I've raised the issue with a number of licensed entities, and so far I haven't gotten any pushback. So, questions?
Questions, Commissioner? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Sean Gillian. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Gillian's representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We are in support of Senate Bill 485. I think it came as a surprise to most of us when we heard, actually, that they didn't have this authority already. As you may know, most of our members are either licensed as real estate agents, or we do have property managers who are licensed as well. We think this is a good common-sense bill, and it could have avoided a troubling situation, and for that reason, we're in support. I'd be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. That's getting easy. No questions? I've seen none. You got off easy, too.
Thank you, Mr.
Jared Kahn.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the Senate Committee. My name is Jared Kahn. I'm an attorney with Reeves, Kahn, Hennessy, and Elkins. Our law firm represents a real estate association called Northwest Real Estate Investors Association. They have about 400 members. I'm sorry, I forgot to give this to you. Excuse me, I'm sorry. They're made up of real estate brokers, mortgage brokers, investors who handle real estate transactions in the state of Oregon and even in Washington. Our firm represents them as counsel and also as lobbyists. We've presented testimony on other bills before, and on this bill, we're fairly concerned that the bill is going to have too far-reaching of an effect and actually violate the Constitution's Due Process Clause. Legally speaking, we agree with the real estate agency that they don't have this authority currently right now to issue a cease and desist order. However, before they issue a cease and desist order, the due process of the Constitution requires that there be a hearing on the merits. The bill also has a provision right now for a preliminary injunction, which would at least provide for a hearing that they have to prove that there's a substantial likelihood of success on the merits, and the alleged wrongdoer will be able to at least face their accuser. With the cease and desist order as it currently stands, there's no room for an objection to be made from the wrongdoer. There's no hearing, and this takes effect as a judgment against the alleged wrongdoer with contempt proceedings that can be initiated before the wrongdoer even has a chance to answer these allegations. My clients and our association we represent are some of the most, they actually educate their members on how to handle real estate transactions and abide by the law. What they're concerned with, though, is if somebody just makes a complaint against them, in this unscrupulous market we have now, there are real estate brokers who might make a complaint against another person, and then the real estate agency just goes and issues a cease and desist order and puts them out of business. We think that this bill is just going too far and is far-reaching without a hearing on the merits so that you can at least answer to these charges against you before the cease and desist order is issued. Certainly just filing something with the county recorder's office is not a hearing on the merits where somebody can come and present their case. There's plenty of times out there where the agency, which has currently a system in place to have hearings, may not prevail on some of those cases, and then the person is not found in violation. In this situation now, they've basically turned into the judiciary branch, making a decision on the merits when they're the executive agency. They've transformed themselves. It's going to be a violation of separation of powers and due process if they're going to be the judge, jury, and executioner here without having a hearing on the merits before the cease and desist order goes through. Certainly my clients, my association that we represent, does not oppose a cease and desist order after hearing on the merits. We do strongly suggest that the real estate agency be granted that type of power or just be limited to only the preliminary injunction where there will be a hearing on the merits if somebody is found to be in violation. Like I said, they will have to present a substantial likelihood of success on the merits. Currently with the cease and desist order, it goes too far, and we ask that the senators amend the bill as proposed such that either the cease and desist order has some form of hearing on the merits, or Section 1A and B is stricken and just limited to a preliminary injunction. When you look at the language of the bill, it's when the real estate agency only has reason to believe that somebody's engaging in, or might engage in the future, activity that's in violation of the real estate activity and requiring a license. The reason to believe language is just too vague. It's not a judicial standard that would be acceptable, and we encourage the senators to at least keep this within the due process requirements by the law. If you have any questions.
Mr. Kahn, isn't that process that you're describing there required under the Administrative Procedures Act anyway?
Your agency? Yes, the agency normally would issue a notice of violation, and somebody would have the chance to respond. The way this bill is written, it appears that they could just go record a cease and desist order. No, there won't be a hearing yet for the person to be able to respond to, and the person's business, they could be shut down.
Mr. Jovanovich, could I ask you to come back?
Chair Beyer.
My understanding is that, I understand what the language here says, but wouldn't the APA require a hearing?
Chair Beyer, you're absolutely correct. A hearing would be required. And let me also note that the only theoretical factual issue that could be in play here is whether the person has a license or not. If you look at the three sections that are specifically mentioned in subsection 1A, 696-0202, 696-511-1, or 696-6031. And those are provisions dealing solely with licensure. So what's never going to be a subject of a cease and desist is whether a person acted poorly in performance of their real estate activities. So if the real estate agency believes that it has grounds to find that someone is acting as a real estate agent without a license, it's a fairly easy thing for them to determine, does the person have a license or not? And then they would have to have a hearing through the Administrative Procedures Act to establish whether somebody is acting as a real estate professional without a license. That's the only issue that would ever be in dispute.
Our only concern, Senator, and we understand it is a licensing requirement issue, there's probably 20-something exemptions in the statute that exempt people from a licensing requirement. Many of my clients within the association fall within those exemptions. However, somebody might make a phone call to the real estate agency and see they're not licensed and issue a cease and desist order. And I think maybe what we might need to clarify then is the cease and desist order only going to happen after the administrative procedure through the APA, or is it going to happen before the final decision by an ALJ? If it's going to happen after an administrative law judge makes a decision that their person's in violation, again, my clients are welcome an actual cease and desist order to protect the public. But prior to somebody actually making a determination, we feel like the Real Estate Association is being granted too much power.
Chair Beyer, the agency, all of its conduct, as you well know, has to follow the Administrative Procedures Act.
So I think, and it isn't spoken to here, but standard, all agencies are subject to the Administrative Procedures Act. I think that the process you're describing is mandated by the APA.
And Your Honor, Senator, I agree that the APA can control and should control. It's our interpretation when you read the statute that it's when the agency has reason to believe that there isn't a final determination yet, they can issue a cease and desist order. It's a preliminary cease and desist order before a final determination is the way the statute's
concerned. Sir, don't you think the first question when they had a complaint would be, do you have a license?
Again, there's 30 probably exemptions which people are not required to have a license, particularly in cases where you're a member of your own LLC and you're selling your own property. Oh, yeah. You are exempt from the licensing requirement and your LLC doesn't have to have a license. However, if the real estate agency just looked up the company and said, oh, they don't have a license, a cease and desist order is going to issue. It just doesn't make any sense before they've determined that the person is exempt from the statute.
But the cease and desist in that case would be against representing other people. Anybody in the state can represent themselves in real estate matters. So you really don't have an issue there unless the person was representing another LLC, which they were not an owner of or an employee of.
And I agree, and that's what the licensing statute says. It's when you're representing another for compensation. However, and I'll be candid with you, Senator, that our firm has even represented individuals who have gone through the process where a notice of violation has been issued against them, and there's a determination made subsequently that maybe the person doesn't need to have a license. I still feel like the agency is being handed the judicial power to make that decision before an administrative law judge determines that a violation has occurred.
I'm still searching for the harm that could be done. I think the issue would be representing other people who are putting, as in the case referenced by Senator Bonamici, their equity and their incomes at risk, as opposed to, even if a cease and desist had been issued, if you're the owner of the property, it has no effect.
Chair Beyer, the cease and desist order would be to not act inconsistent with the Act, which is if you don't have a license, you shouldn't be acting as a real estate professional. That's it.
Thank you. Other questions? I don't want to monopolize this.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senators.
That is all I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Okay. Please come forward.
Chair Beyer, Vice Chairman Atkinson, Senators on the committee. My name is Courtney Goodman. I'm with Northwest Real Estate Investors Association, based up in Portland. I want to thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony regarding this Senate Bill 485. We're here today representing Northwest REIA, and we are a nonprofit organization comprised of real estate investors, brokers, lenders, appraisers, builders, attorneys, contractors, landlords, and an entire host of diversified members working in the real estate industry. Our purpose, as stated in our bylaws, is to educate our members in the the general public about investing in real estate and to provide instruction and dissemination of educational materials that are also in the public interest. I say all that because we think it's important to illustrate to the committee that we focus on educating our members in a variety of real estate areas with great emphasis on ethics and complying with Oregon law. Our members are citizens just like you, going to work every day and contributing to the state of Oregon. Many of our members are full-time real estate investors like myself, who have chosen this industry as their profession. As Senate Bill 485 is currently written, the agency would hold judicial power prior to the accused being proven guilty and without the opportunity for the accused to challenge the accusation. The agency can simply declare someone guilty before proving they are indeed guilty, and the passing of this bill could have far-reaching and unintended consequences. Any legitimate small business owner would be susceptible to shuttering their business without violating any Oregon statute. For example, and we've heard this just before we took this the mic, any disgruntled person could simply file a complaint, whether founded or not, with the agency, and the agency could in turn record a cease and desist order without a hearing and file an injunction without proof of any violation. Senate Bill 45 provides for the total shutdown of an honest and viable Oregon business if the real estate agency believes or simply suspects someone is engaging or is thinking about engaging in violations of the various statutes cited in this proposal. This bill provides broad-reaching powers for the agency to record a cease and desist order and create an injunction against an individual prior to the agency producing proof of any wrongdoing, without a hearing and without due process. And that's mainly what we're here just to say, is there's no due process mentioned in this proposal. The board of directors and membership of Northwest REIA, which I'm a member of and am on the board, I've been sitting on the board for 3 years now, acknowledge the concerns of the agency to protect the citizens of Oregon from unlicensed professional real estate activity within the state. We're all for that. Our association goes to great lengths to support the public good. We work closely with our realtor associates and members, and what we do also do is provide top-notch, up-to-date, and state-specific education to our growing membership. Most importantly, we all strive and teach our members to engage in activities within the law. We can certainly understand and agree with the agency's necessity to protect the statutes that are currently on Oregon's books for good reason. There are already statutory lines drawn delineating professional real estate activity and the exemptions that Jared Kahn mentioned. When these lines are blurred, the agency currently follows remedies with due process and the Constitution in mind. 485 strips all of this and simply goes too far by immediately equating any complaint the agency receives as a guilty verdict. Senate Bill 45 essentially allows the agency to shoot first and ask questions later. Our association respectfully requests this bill not move forward.
Thank you. Good afternoon, and thank you for hearing us. My name is John Sheldon. My company is Equity Home Solutions. I've been a full-time real estate investor for 11 years. I purchased 50-plus single-family homes, owned, rehabbed them, sold some, I hold some, and I currently manage a small portfolio of rentals of my own. I'm a legitimate businessman making my full-time living off real estate investing. I've spent over $500,000 with general contractors over the years. Rehabbing and restoring homes. I'm a principal in my own LLC. In all of these transactions, I'm a principal or my LLC is a principal in all the transactions. And it seems by the way we read the bill before we when we chose to come today was that word for word, it seems as though it could jeopardize my livelihood and the income and the livelihoods of the general contractors and subcontractors and many other individuals. It reads word for word that we would not have due process. When I heard the discussion with Mr. Kahn and the other gentleman that was up here, it was a little confusing as far as when that cease and desist order would be imposed and relative to whether we do or do not have a license. I am not currently licensed, and I fit in under one of the exemptions, obviously. So my question is, could I, and there are peers of mine in our organization that at some point have been accused of conducting real estate business without a license. By the wording of this bill, it appears that they could be stopped from their business if someone thought they perhaps should have a license, as it is written. It seems like there are many unintended consequences to the bill the way it is written. We'd appreciate the rewriting or amending of the bill as Mr. Kahn has suggested, or that it not move forward.
Thank you. Go ahead. Hello. My name is Judy Moore, and I, too, am a member of the Northwest REIA Investing Group. And as an organization, we really do strive to follow the law and, you know, make every situation that we're in a win-win situation for everybody. But as we read this law and as we've kicked it around, or this proposed law, we look at it and we're confused. And, you know, in our mind, in order for a law to be what, you know, I would loosely say a good law, it needs to be clear, fair, and have a presumption of innocence to comply with the procedural due process. And that's where, just as average citizens out here looking at this bill, we start saying, uh-oh, you know, I can see myself getting caught in this web when, you know, I do my very best, you know, to understand the law, to comply with the law, especially when it says in this law that one who engages or is about to engage in an activity, it also goes on to say, all the agency has to do is have a reason to believe that the person has engaged, is engaging, or is about to engage in the violation. And, you know, my mind probably goes too far, but I can read into that possibly I could actually be punished for just thinking about doing something. And I don't really think that's the intent of this law, but when I look at it, you know, and I start getting nervous, that's what comes to my mind. And, you know, we all agree that, you know, all of the citizens out here in Oregon need to be protected on both sides. You know, we are non-licensed people, and we want, you know, to do right by the people that we work with. And they, you know, everybody deserves to have the protection of the law. But we're just asking that in this situation, we feel like it's gone too far, because we feel that the process that, you know, first of all, we wouldn't have an impartial judge, which, you know, the 14th Amendment says that we get to have an impartial judge, because the one making this decision as to whether our behavior is within the law is, you know, the real estate agency, you know, whoever that person would be. And, you know, they have, you know, more of a bent towards licensees as opposed to unlicensed people. We also, you know, wouldn't have the right to present evidence on our behalf. We don't feel that we'd have right to notice in a hearing or to confront our accuser or to have legal representation or to a public and speedy process as far as resolving this, because, you know, if somebody thought we were maybe going to do this and turned us in, the way we read the statute is that this order, this you know, to cease and desist would then be issued, we'd be stopped in our tracks because we follow the law. And not only that, then it would also be given the legal weight of a judgment. And, of course, a judgment is something that's already been tried by, you know, in court or a trier of fact, the bench, whatever. But here, they would have the right to give it the judgment, the weight of a judgment, and they could have contempt proceedings against us. And all of this, as we read this, and like I say, we're just regular people, but as we read this, we feel like it, you know, has a huge opportunity to do harm to us in that we would be stopped in our tracks without, you know, any of the due process protections that, as citizens of the United States, the 14th Amendment affords us. So that's all we're saying, is we just want it to be clear on its face. We want to know when we've crossed the line. You know, as just regular citizens, you know, we're not really familiar with this Administrative Procedure Act that you guys have referred to. I believe it's there. I just don't have the expertise. And I want to be able to read the law and know what it is I'm supposed to do, and then I'm going to do it. And I feel like this law doesn't protect me. It goes too far. So in that vein, you know, I'm just asking that, you know, whatever happens with this, that it's, you know, both sides as far as, you know, protections on for both groups of people, because we obviously, both of us, both sides need to have protection, that this is just made clear on its face so that, you know, we do have, you know, the 14th Amendment due process afforded us and that nobody's harmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello there. My name is Anita Borges, and I am a licensed real estate broker here in Oregon, and I'm also a member of the Northwest REIA Club, and I work very closely with a lot of different real estate investors here in the Portland area. And the one thing for me reading the law and how I thought it was unclear is that, you know, there's times when you're meeting with actual potential clients that you may be talking about listing their house and something of that nature, and you are actually rubbing elbows with other real estate investors that they may have met with, that may be talking to them about buying their house. I see this as a real estate broker, actually, where they could actually, all they would have to do is just call the real estate agency, make a complaint, and then therefore put that other real estate investor, just by making a complaint, actually just put them out of business, or at least temporarily out of business, and then therefore eliminate competition. And that is something that I could see happen quite a bit, actually. And so that's basically how I read it.
I'm curious, of the panel, would you feel more comfortable if it asked for a show cause before?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Something where we could defend ourselves or anyone who's accused of it before we're shut down out of business.
Well, understand under this, there's nothing under this that would threaten your actual business, because the sections that are referenced here speak to licensed real estate brokers, as you know, and licensed property managers. All this law says is that you cannot perform the duties for somebody else for compensation unless you have a license. That's the existing law. All this does is says if you're doing it, you got to stop doing it, which would not preclude you from representing your own property. But I understand the confusion.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Other questions?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Atkinson.
Thank you all four for coming. Can you tell me more about how this association works? I mean, I think somebody referred to it as a club and others.
Yeah, we're a nonprofit 501c6 in Portland. We have 300 plus members. You heard me tell the range of the experiences and brokers, and it's mainly real estate investor professionals here in Oregon. We have a main meeting once a month, but we have 8 satellite meetings during the month as well, teach real estate from, you know, from landlording, and there's a rental housing association up in Portland as well, but we're a standalone group, and it's a very valuable meeting. You know, we can't grab every investor in Oregon and say, hey, this is the right way to do business, but the people that by and large that are in our club know that we're saying, hey, stay on the right side of things, and if you're not licensed, don't practice professional real estate without a license.
So, Mr. Chair, So when you say club, there's no pooling of funds or anything?
Not, it's just, no. No, there's membership dues. There's, like, you know, as a couple or a single person, you, $150 for the year.
Which you're buying your legal counsel with, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right?
We don't pull funds. That's, yeah, there's none of that. So.
Basically, more like a trade association.
Pretty much, yeah. And we've enlisted Reeves, Conn, and Hennessy and Elkin to, you know, when bills like this come up that we, you know, maybe we don't, can't interpret correctly, we have our attorney firm, you know, get us down here and say, hey, this bill does not look good for you guys. And, of course, we want to stay on the right side of things. And we don't want to get lumped in. We want to have our due process. We don't see it here as written. And if it is there on, you know, outside of this bill, that's great. But we don't want to be proven. We would just said, hey, you guys are guilty without any due process to say, hey, we're not. Or just have our day. So we appreciate your time.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lori Skillman?
Hi, Chair Byers, members of the committee. My name, for the record, my name is Lori Skillman. I'm with the State of Oregon Real Estate Agency. I do, in addition to some other things, I'm a manager, and I do a lot of the legislative coordination. And I did a thorough analysis of this bill. A couple of things as to some of the comments that were made today. First, all state agencies are under the Administrative Procedures Act, as the chairman so spoke. There's criminal proceedings, civil proceedings, and administrative proceedings. So the real estate agency, as does every other state agency, falls under that, and it falls under Chapter 186, which is the APA, and all the administrative rules that go with that. So if the agency's going to issue an order against a licensee or a cease and desist against an unlicensed person, then first, you need to know that the agency is going to investigate anything before it goes through an administrative process. Second is to make a determination about whether they're licensed or not and whether they fall under one of the 30 exemptions that were mentioned. Any kind of order requires a notice and an opportunity for a hearing. So if we issue a notice and they want a hearing on it, then it goes to the Office of Administrative Hearings and there's a hearing on the matter. But the state can't just issue a cease and desist order and have it stand out there. What this law allows the agency to do is then to take that order, once it's final, go in and record it in the county lien records. The second thing was that this language is, with the exception of the statutory references to Chapter 696, is verbatim the same language that's in Board of Accountancy, building codes for all the trade licenses, Chapter 59 for the securities laws, all licensing regulatory agencies who have cease and desist orders have exactly the same language. So I just wanted to kind of clarify those things. If you have any questions, I'm happy to answer.
Questions?
I answered my question.
Thank you.
You answered the question I had. So.
Any other questions? So, Mr. Gonbridge, just to be clear, for the benefit of the committee, could you just clarify how the APA, again, affects all of this?
Chair Byer, as Ms. Gilman just said, the Administrative Procedures Act and all of the applicable regulations governs all conduct by all state agencies. Anyone who is subject to an investigation or an inquiry by a state agency is obviously entitled to the assistance of a lawyer should they so desire. They are given an opportunity to respond to inquiries. It may involve oral testimony or it may involve just written testimony. The agency always gives a responding party notice of what the charges or accusations are so that the responding party can respond. there is, as has been referenced, an administrative law judge, which is independent of, in this case, the real estate agency that would be making the determination on whether there are sufficient grounds for the issuance of a cease and desist order. So there is due process that exists under Oregon law, under both the Administrative Procedures Act and the applicable regulations.
Questions? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on this? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 485 and open a work session on Senate Bill 485. The chair would move Senate Bill 485 to the floor with a due pass. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, one addition that you raised that the group nodded their head to.
I'm sorry.
You raised a potential amendment idea.
A show cause, but that's essentially what Ms. Skillman and Assistant District Attorney General Keith Bonovich spoke to. That's essentially what you have is it's standard process under the APA for an agency to issue that. And besides, after that, as you have to describe, you have to go out and you have to give notice. Provide the opportunity for an administrative appeal by the administrative law judge panel and before they can take action. So I think, understandably, that's what people were asking for. It's not, if you weren't familiar with that, you wouldn't know that from what's written here. But that's what that reference was all about.
To follow up on, if we amended it so that to make sure that it did come under the APA and that was in the bill, I think they would rest a lot easier, and it's not that tough a thing to do.
I suppose you can do that, but that's redundant because that is state law already.
This legislature, we love redundancy.
Well, make it less clear. Further discussion. I'm sensing a roll call vote here. Could you call the roll, please?
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Edwards?
Aye.
Senator Dorn?
Oh, no.
Senator
Starr? Nope.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
I'll call for recess.
It's a good bill, but I just, why not touch it up?
Why don't we touch it up?
Well, I guess we have to vote and we can reconsider it.
All right. No.
Buyer will vote no on the prevailing side and move for reconsideration. So let's call on discussion on reconsideration. I guess we don't need that. Vote.
Roll call. What is the purpose of reconsideration?
Reconsideration, put it back. The motion failed, so we can move to reconsider it, the bill.
And take another vote on up or down?
Not today.
Okay.
It's going to get an amendment.
Go, please, call the roll.
On reconsideration. Yeah. Yeah, can we clarify, Mr. Chair, what we're voting on now?
We're reconsidering 485.
Put it back on the table.
The table.
Aye.
Senator Edwards?
Aye.
Senator Braun?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair Byer?
Aye, and I suppose then we don't have to table it, just to reconsider it. To be official, we will vote. The chair moves that Senate Bill 485 be tabled.
Okay. Let's just take it to the Department of Redundancy Department.
Yes, indeedy. So. So call the roll, please.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Edwards?
Aye.
Senator Gerard?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Vice Chair Atkinson?
Yes.
Chair Byer?
Aye. Senate Bill 485 is tabled. We'll now move to Senate Bill, public hearing on Senate Bill 156. Please.
Thank you, Chair. Senate Bill 156 delineates affirmative duties owed by a real estate property manager to a property owner. There's no revenue impact, and I have not received the fiscal on the original bill, but on the Dash 1 amendments, there's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact.
Lori Spielman? Want to try this one?
This is just a Senator Byer, members of the committee. Thank you. For the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm a manager with the State of Oregon Real Estate Agency, and the real estate agency is testifying in support of this bill and of the Dash 1 amendments, which we are also offering today. It's my understanding there are Dash 2 amendments that you will see in a little bit. Excuse me, sir. I have some written testimony that outlines the bill and also does a section-by-section analysis of the bill for you. I won't read my testimony. I'll simply tell you what the bill does. At the real estate agency, one of the things that we do is we convene working groups of members of the industry, of the real estate board, and staff members, and look at administrative rulemaking and potential statutory changes. This bill is a result of those work groups, those collaborative work groups that we had. There were certain provisions that the work groups came to consensus on changing. We then took those changes to the real estate board, which also approved the agency going forward with this bill. It's kind of a thick bill, and the reason that it's so many pages is that there are a number of sort of technical and housekeeping amendments to the bill. However, there are a couple of new substantive provisions. The first provision that's substantive is a provision that outlines affirmative duties for property managers. The agency for a long time has had affirmative duties for real estate brokers and principal real estate brokers. We've licensed property managers a little bit more recently than brokers, and these specific affirmative duties come for them. So these are the affirmative duties that a property manager owes a property owner. Things like a duty to be loyal, a duty of disclosure, a duty of handling trust funds, which often a property manager will have hundreds of thousands of dollars in client trust funds, to act in a fiduciary manner in terms of those trust funds. The second substantive provision in the bill has to do with a new requirement for licensed property managers, which is something called an advanced practices course. So between the time a property manager gets his or her license and the two-year renewal period, they will have to take an advanced practices course in property management. We already have an advanced practice course for brokers, so now we're going to do that for property managers. Another substantive provision is last session we Senate Bill 640 was introduced and passed, and that created a number of new provisions for continuing education for real estate licensees. We're tweaking just a couple provisions in there. One is to become a certified continuing education provider. We're allowing attorneys to be certified providers. There's already a list of people who would qualify, and so that was added to the list. The other thing, it allows the real estate agency to provide continuing education on its own and for people to get credit for that. Right now, we kind of couldn't do that because we can't really license ourselves to do something. It just kind of doesn't work under the law. The other kinds of provisions are technical. One's for registered business names, which we already have, and we require in rule for them to be registered with the Secretary of State as a business name. We just wanted to move that into statute so that became a real clear provision. There's nothing else that sort of rises to the level of true substantive provisions. They're kind of technical provisions. And then a whole lot of housekeeping to make things, our statutes are readable and clear and easy for the public to understand. We spent a lot of time doing that. So Erica Kleiner's to my left. She will speak to the -1 amendments.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. As Rory mentioned, I'm here to speak to the -1 amendment. The purpose of the -1 amendment is to amend
ORS. Could you put your name on record, please?
For the record, I'm Erica Kleiner with the State of Oregon Real Estate Agency. The purpose of the -1 amendment is to amend ORS 696-270. This is the statute which provides for the fees charged by the agency. As background, the agency recently issued an RFP to procure for a licensing examination provider. Our current contract expires June 30th, 2011. As part of our commitment to regulatory streamlining, the RFP requires the vendor to provide examination services and also digital fingerprinting services at the test sites, and to also collect the fees for those services directly. Currently, the agency collects the fees for both the examination and the fingerprinting, and we pay those same fees to the vendor. So essentially, the fees are passing through our budget. Under the new contract, the examination provider will provide the services and collect the fees directly. It will essentially provide a one-stop process for the applicant. It will also serve to dramatically decrease the time the process takes for the applicant. This follows a successful model that was recently implemented by the Department of Consumer and Business Services Insurance Division. The -1 amendment deletes the words "and paid to" the real estate agency, just the words "and paid to." The Assistant Attorney General that advised the agency on the RFP advised us to pursue the statutory change so that the examination provider could collect the statutorily set fees. On February 16th, we had our agency budget hearing, and the agency testified that we would propose this amendment. We have worked with Legislative Fiscal Office to permanently phase out the corresponding expenditure limitation from our budget. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Senator Rutt?
I'm being lazy, not wanting to look up ORS 696.010. Real estate property manager is defined as what?
Senator Beyer, Senator Girard. 696.010 is the definitional section in Chapter 696, and one of the things that we've struggled with is language and certain definitions. We have real estate broker, principal real estate broker, and then a real estate property manager. And then we call real estate licensees all three of those. That's the way that our statute is constructed. One of the problems is distinguishing someone whose license is a property manager, and that individual can only do property management. They can't do buying and selling and representing buyers and sellers of houses. Strictly property management. However, brokers under the supervision of a principal broker or principal brokers can do the management of rental real estate, property management. So we needed to distinguish licensed real estate property managers and people who were engaged in the management of rental real estate, which is all of our licensees. So we worked hard to make those distinctions in the language.
I'm still missing
that.
Okay, it's clear as mud. But it's a real estate property manager is someone that has a real estate license, but has the right to manage property, but he has outside interests, or he or she, I should say.
Aren't they limited to managing property? They can't represent either a purchaser or a seller.
That's correct, Senator.
We lose you?
No, that's fine.
Let me see if I can try and restate it to be clear. You have three classes that are licensed, like a lot of things. You have a person who can be licensed. It's a more limited license just to be a property manager.
Okay.
Or you can have someone that's licensed to be a broker, which means they have also passed the test to be a property manager and a sales representative. And then you have a third class, which is more intensive training and experience that can be a principal broker who most brokers, the first two, work for. Sort of a journeyman, if you will.
That's correct.
All right.
Does that help?
Hmm.
We should have done this bill first. Other questions?
I got the legislative. Mr. Chair, may
yes.
I ask? I was a little confused. I understand that you have the legislative fiscal on the Dash 1 amendments and on the original bill both, correct?
We don't have the fiscal on the original bill. But it doesn't matter. As
perfect.
We can only pass it with the Dash 1s. We couldn't pass the original bill until I get a fiscal on that.
Excellent. Very good. Thank you.
So we could have, I mean, if the committee so chose, they could adopt the Dash 1s today.
They could pass the Dash 1s.
With the Dash 1s.
Sure.
Yep.
Okay.
Oh. But we couldn't pass it without the Dash 1s.
Right. So we couldn't.
We have the fiscal on the Dash 1s.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Gillian. So the realtors want to pay these fees, and do you like the bill?
Thank you. I'm afraid to come up here, Mr. Chair.
You want to take a shot at property management?
Yeah. The non-controversial bills are the scariest ones in this building, apparently. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Sean Gillian's representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. We are in support of the bill. We are in support of the Dash 1s. In addition, Mr. Chair, I have worked with your staff to craft the Dash 2s, and it appears that those haven't gotten the committee staff, so I apologize on that matter. But we do have Dash 2 amendments, which just clarify a couple things relating to fiduciary duties. And the other relates to record-keeping requirements for continuing education courses. When legislative council was going through and cleaning up the language relating to record-keeping, which is a six-year requirement, and transactions, they accidentally swept in our continuing education requirements, which under rule right now are 3 years. So they doubled the length of time that our licensees needed to keep those records. The Dash 2s are very limited. They're four lines, and that's what they do. I have worked with the real estate agency on those as well. So I apologize for not getting those to committee staff. I thought that your staff had gotten them to them, and it's one of those assumed cases.
But unfortunately, if we don't adopt the Dash 1s, I don't think we'll get a fiscal on the Dash 2s. So we may have to, committee desires, look at that. Any questions, Ms. Gillian? That's all I have signed up for this. It's at great risk. Is there anybody else who wants to testify?
I'm staying here.
Mr. Chair, do we have clarification that the bill's okay with the Dash 1s without the Dash 2s? Or
I think we need the Dash 2s
as a whole package?
Okay. From our perspective, Mr. Chair, Senator Edwards, we would need the Dash 2s in there as well.
Okay.
I believe we have the assent of the agency as well.
Thank you.
So, is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Seeing none, at great risk, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 156, open work session on Senate Bill 156, and move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 156. Is there a discussion?
Do you want to do that when the Dash 2s are coming?
If we don't, we can't get a revised fiscal.
But you're going to need a revised fiscal for the Dash 2s.
No, you can get a fiscal.
We can?
You don't need to do that.
Well, they'll give us a fiscal on both. That's not what they said in the chair's meeting today.
No, they'll give you a fiscal on the Dash 2s.
My understanding is they would give us fiscal.
No.
I mean,
speaking for fiscal is a bit bold statement.
Tell you what, I will withdraw the motion. This is not going well today. So we will just close the work session on Senate Bill 156 and see if you can get a fiscal on the whole thing, and we'll try it again another day. Thank you.
Now we'll move on to see if we can try another one. Now we're at Senate Bill 581, and Richard.
Senate Bill 581, Senator Wittstard spoke on it. It creates an alternative contracting review board and prescribes board membership duties and functions. There's no revenue impact, and we have not yet received a statement from fiscal on this measure.
Thank you. Let's see. Mr. Hyland.
Thank you, Chairman Beyer, committee members. For the record, my name is Sean Hyland. I'm on here on behalf of John Hyland Construction. We're a general contractor located in Springfield. I want to talk briefly about the CMGC model and the intent of it originally was brought about for complicated remodel projects or emergency projects that need to get built without having the time to go out, have a project designed, and bid out to multiple general contractors that can bond it for any public contracting. Since that time, which is, I believe, around 97, I'm guessing it might be a five-year period, that this was put into place, it started off with that intent, and there were still many projects available to publicly bid as long as you could bond the project. At this day and age, that model has since morphed itself into any public agency that would like to now go what they call CMGC can pretty much raise their hand and say, yeah, I want to go, and then you're free to do that, which basically means that you've taken out the public bidding requirements for a public project and made it a proposal-based requirement. And what I mean by proposal-based is it's become very subjective, and cost is not an issue on any kind of proposal that's out there. You'll see a proposal will basically, you're going to be scored on how well you write your proposal and how well you say the things that make the review committee of the proposal sparkle. They don't ask for any costing that goes with it. So you're not getting a very good deal. And what's happened is you'll see in the Lane County, where I'm at, it's put a big dent in the local general contractors, and you could probably hit any town where a home-based local contractor is, I mean, a company that can do anywhere from 20 to 60 million a year in volume. It's a decent-sized company that can handle large-sized projects. I would tell you that it's put a big dent in their workload for the fact that we're not able to compete with the $500 million to billion-dollar-a-year companies to $6 billion-a-year companies that are national or global that have full marketing departments that roll into town and have a portfolio that you just can't compete with. And the biggest question that gets asked on any proposal is, how many of these projects have you done? How many laboratories, just like mine, have you built? Well, if you're a local contractor, it doesn't mean you can't build it. It just means that you haven't had the opportunity to build one because you're based in a local area and you don't have the resources to work all over the world. So we'd really like to see this get changed to get, you know, some competitiveness back into the environment and give opportunities to local contractors to keep the money that's being spent into the community. I got a couple, for instances. We call them the big contractors when they come into town. We recently constructed two elementary schools in Springfield. One was Maple and one was Thurston. And the bid on the project was $28.5 million. We were the low bidder on the job. There was one other bidder on the job, and it's a company that typically does CMGC work. The reason I'm saying this is those companies, quite honestly, don't know how to bid very good. They're not competitive. The reason I say that is they were $4.5 million higher than us. Now, you can imagine if you're bidding a project and you turn in your number and you're $4.5 million low, you're going to be shaking in your boots a little bit, my father and I worked together, and I had to calm him down because I had to let him know, hey, Dad, this is a CMGC contractor. These guys don't know how to bid. And it was a successful project for us. And the reason I bring this up is we had to fight with the school board to get them to leave it as a competitive bid project. They wanted to go CMGC, and we had to fight with them to tell them, if you do, it's going to cost you money. Because the guys come in with the dog and pony show, and if they would have, they would have had, you know, all the big boys from all over the place come down and give them a big wow factor, because they like that kind of stuff. But that just shows you that those companies can't compete. Another project we bid for the University of Oregon, it was called the Living Learning Center. If you've ever been to Hayward Fields, across the street, two nice dormitories. Competitive bid project. We were at a $20 million bid, and the next above us was $22 million, and it was another company that is primarily just CMGC work. So once again, we saved $2 million by bidding the job that would never have gotten recognized had they've gone CMGC model. You know, so it's just a couple of things that kind of, you know, bounce out there. And what's kind of happened with the CMGC model is there's just a lot of favoritism, and I don't care how you say it, and there's no way to prove it, because there's a system where you score how the proposals came through and how they wrote it, how they talked about staffing, and how they talked about scheduling and approach, and then there's a little scoring for your fee. So they give you 10 points for your fee, maybe 20 points for your fee, which is the cost. That's the cost of the taxpayer. And then the rest of the points go about all the nice things you said and how sparkly your proposal looked with the great pictures you put on and everything else. So we as general contractors, you know, our company was started in 1978, and we've been very successful. Because we were given the opportunity to give a great product for the best price, and we're going to be a dying breed if we don't get back to that. Because right now, we're being judged on what we say and how nice and good of buddies we are with people in different public agencies. And it's real. It's happening. If you were to look in the University of Oregon and look at how many jobs have gone to one company or maybe just a couple companies that have been negotiated CMGC projects, it'd blow your mind. I had the facilities director flat tell me out when I called him out on it that he said, yeah, we kind of do favor a few companies. And that's public money, and it happens with Lane Community College, the city of Eugene. The jobs are going out, and I'm being told, why didn't I get the job? What did I do wrong? And you didn't really say the right things. You just didn't really come. Your proposal didn't look that great. So the public money is being spent based on how somebody's proposal looks. Maybe they don't like my logo. I don't know. So it's something that it was probably a good thing when it started, because there was I can imagine, and I know it was, when we've taken on major complicated remodel jobs that were bid out, and it's a mess. So there's a need for CMGC, and there's also a need to kind of get it, you know, where there's a review of the people that are putting these together, making these decisions, selecting these general contractors, to hold them under a little more scrutiny. Because right now, they have free rein to pick whoever they want, however they want, and basically do it. I mean, they can choose to go CMGC, and I've seen it happen. And I've had to go to meetings with school boards and counties and cities and try to, you know, tell you what I'm telling you right now, and thanks to some people around me, this is getting to where it is now, and this is a great cause, and I totally support this bill. That's it.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Girard. Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chairman. Question I have is, I agree in principle with what you're saying, but the reality of the situation, too, is that there are some contractors out there who might give the low bid, who probably aren't the ones that you want to have building your project. Somebody that maybe has never done anything over $1 million and it's a $20 million bid, or someone that has a record of court cases and for inept work or something like that. How can we modify this so that the agency does have the option to not go with the lowest bidder?
Well, that would be why you have to bond a project. So if you've never done a $20 million job and your largest job is $1 million, there's nobody out there that's going to bond that contractor. And then the other resource is the Construction Contractor Board. If they've been out there and they've been fined and they've been, you know, over and over again, then that's gonna follow through. And there's already things in place that will bar them from bidding any public contracting laws. You can only do a couple strikes in a public contracting situation and you're done. you can't bid any more of those projects. So there's already items in place to me, and especially the way our financial times are now, if you wanted to bid a $20 million job and your largest job was $1 million, you're not going to get a bond. I mean, there's nobody out there in their right mind that's going to roll the dice on you the way the times are, and give you a bond to do that job. So that to me is where you're safe. And let's say it is a company that has done $20 million jobs and they have a bond in place, So if something happens to that company, you're covered because you got a bond. You got a bonding company that's going to stand behind and do whatever they have to take to come in and get that job done.
Follow up?
Well, I understand the bonding process, but let's use the little fiasco next door over here. The architects, they can have a bond, but the bond isn't going to cover the whole building. The bond, maybe say it was $1 million worth of architecture, just for example. But, the heck, it wasn't even that much, say $500,000. And so their liability on that building isn't the whole scope of what the problem was. So what I'm saying is, you can have a bond all you want, but that doesn't mean that it's going to cover the whole project.
The construction bond is for the entire construction amount of the building. So if it's a $30 million construction cost, you've got a $30 million bond.
Well, I can tell you that the bond that was done on that building over there was insufficient to carry...
Was that a CMGC job or competitive bid? I believe it's CMGC, and that's why they were a little under more scrutiny. I don't know. I don't have the knowledge.
Well, we had the engineers in. All we learned about it was that it'll cost more to take it down than it did to build it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, but all I can say is for many years we worked, under those rules where we bid jobs, we bonded them, and a lot of good buildings got put up.
Senator Starr?
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I really appreciate it. We have a hearing on 581, correct? That's where we're open under. So that's a proposed solution to the challenges that you outlined in your testimony. But my question is that the right solution? Is there other ways that we could tackle this issue as instead of creating a new bureaucracy that would require every public agency to jump through all these additional hoops? Is there another way to crack this particular problem?
This was the one solution. I mean, I really believe that it needs to be brought back into, and when Jerry gets there, we can talk more about it, but there's laws in place that I think if we put back in, and the least amount I know is that at least the Oregon University systems have exempted themselves from the ORS 279, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, get all the public agencies back in line and put a little more scrutiny on it and have them have to go to, somewhere other than just, their local school board to say, hey, you guys cool if we do CMGC? Yeah, that we are. Cause it's just too easy. And I don't have the solution for that. I just know that right now it's too loosey-goosey. It's too easy to be able to do it. And like I've said, I really don't know how you could say, okay, you guys go CMGC, but we want to make sure you're fair. Well, how do you prove they're being fair? It's a tough one to do.
Just to follow up, have you had a chance to look at Senate Bill 772
as an
alternative?
No.
That bill's up. Hopefully we'll get to that this afternoon as well. So thank you.
Okay.
More? Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.
Laura Alexander.
Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Laura Alexander. I had been working for Robert Gray Partners Incorporated in project management for public construction since May 2003 for projects up to $10 million, building colleges and lower-level education, park facilities, gymnasiums, and even Oregon State University's Goss Stadium. In 2002, Oregon State Legislature passed Senate Bill 437 without asking those who would be affected. They agreed with the Oregon University System and Associated General Contractors in changing the future of public contracting by way of allowing OUS to exempt 100% of their publicly funded projects from the bidding process. In that same Senate bill,
They allowed OUS to make it so that Oregon University Foundation would not be subject to disclosing who their donations came from and who those donations were delivered to. Prior to Senate Bill 437, even every seasoned construction company had the opportunity to bid and work on OUS public construction projects by way of ORS 279. By 2005, no bid public funded capital construction projects with a level of 50%. By 2009, after the announcement of the fallout of banks and the defunding of commercial construction projects and the worst catastrophe in the housing market began to disrupt OUS system, and almost every public agency turned their cheek on medium and small-sized companies and said, let them eat cake. By 2009, almost 100% of public-funded construction contracts were no bid. Historically, those contract awards were signed over to AGC's highest-earning construction companies. Those same companies' names are shown on AGC's other assumed name, Oregon Public Contracting Coalition, and members and contributors to the content of their white papers, which they will or have referred to you today. Those white papers written by Oregon University System and AGC contracts outline and sell no-bid public construction contracts. OUS will argue about the size of the projects and bonding capability. The governor's approved capital construction project list compared to the contracts provided by OUS demonstrate that smaller contracts were bundled into multiple award contracts known as MADOCs. Special scheduling, you will also hear arguments about how important it is that CMGC is in place to facilitate special scheduling. I want you to note that every public construction contract management includes special scheduling to be scheduled around the facility scheduling. Public construction contracts have become a golden ticket for high pay, high fees, and overloaded with overpaid and unnecessary management in a poor economy. There are few public construction general contractors and CMGC management companies that would tell the taxpayer the truth about Oregon's version of exempted public construction no-bid contracts. However, they told me, and their answer is after a laugh, that we make so much money off of it. ORS 279C335 competitive bidding exemptions. It says it is unlikely that the exemption will encourage favoritism in the awarding of public improvement contracts or substantially diminish competition for public improvement contracts. It also says the awarding of public improvement contracts under the exemption will likely result in substantial cost savings in the contracting agency. That is impossible under CMGC as they charge up to 20% of the end project cost to afford the management that was normally free and part of the construction contract. However, by granting these public agencies the right to remove taxpayer-afforded public construction projects from the public bidding process closes the door on other qualified contractors wanting to work on such projects. Essentially, Oregon State Legislature and public entities are the driving force for the final collapse of many of Oregon's construction industry-related businesses, just as Robert Gray Partners Incorporated. He is one of the Oregon's qualified general contractors of public construction, which has been denied the right to continue to bid or work on such projects due to the Oregon State Legislature's decision to block competition on public construction contracts. Ironically, this morning I used Kinko's, located on Commercial Street, the very building where I stood up in 2009 to protest against Salem Kaiser's exemption of over $200 million of public construction contracts. I sent a formal letter to the school district asking, begging for them not to exempt those construction contracts from the bidding process. They smugly turned to me and they said, we will do as we want. I ended up standing there and I turned to them and I said, I hope that every parent in this neighborhood that whose child attends your school finds out what you did today. I hope your churches find out. What they did is they awarded $17 million worth of public construction contracts to a company located on McAdam Boulevard in Portland, Oregon, rather than using local contractors in their area. That very day, over 200 homes within a five-mile radius in Salem, Oregon, were in foreclosure. After Senate Bill 338A was introduced, where Oregon State University and several other public agencies had come forward and asked for further exemptions. Oregon State Legislature allowed increases in the budgets substantially. As a result of that, no bid contracts came in abundance. Owens Hall at Oregon Institute of Technology was increased to $35,181,000, and that contract went to Robinson Construction, which was no bid. Phase 2 steam loop overhaul at Portland State University was increased to $17,500,000, and that contract was given to Fortis. Western Oregon University was increased by $12 million, and that contract was given to Hoffman. Oregon University System campuses was increased to $34,614,000, and also their science building in Lincoln Hall, and those contracts were given to Howard S. Wright, no bid. Newberg Hall was given to Lewis Crutcher Lewis at no bid. Portland State University plus renovations of Heckert was given to Walsh Construction, no bid. Reed was given to Howard S. Wright, no bid. Waldo Halls was given to Fortis Construction, no bid. Strand Agricultural Building was no bid. $12 million was added to the capital construction for the Health and Wellness Center for Oregon State University and was given to Hoffman, no bid. Western Oregon University was raised to $6 million and was given to Hoffman, no bid. The Department of Community College and Workforce Development raised their contracts for Clackamas by $2.5 million, Temecula by $10 million, and exempted all projects. Portland Community College was raised by $6,600,000. Those went no bid.
Excuse me, Ms. Alexander. You're just sort of reading to us all the contracts
which
we have.
Because it goes on.
A lot of people testify.
I do get that. And all I want to explain to you is that making these contracts no bid has killed the competition. These are taxpayer-afforded contracts. And I'm asking you, the same people that put you in your positions today, I'm asking you for you to do them right and allow the passing of Senate Bill 581. It creates like a united union between the unions, the non-union contractors, and also the minority contractors as well. It allows them a seat on this board, allows them to examine projects that are considered no bid, and gives them a right to be able to look into those contracts.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's see, John Harbach. Hey, Rakowicz, you can come up too if you want. You're up next.
Not sure.
Good afternoon, Senator Beyer, members of the committee. John Hartsock with Beaverton School District. The district opposes this bill. It really creates a duplication of requirements and costs for the ability to use this really vital tool in looking at projects. In the last 4 years, we completed a $290 million bond project basically touching all of our schools, some 53 schools. It was about 30 projects. Of those, we used CMGC 15 times because it was the right answer and the right tool. We have to take this with a report to the school board as the local contract review board, as do cities, counties, and special districts, DAS and others, for their review of this information. We would, in essence, be creating the exact same process to bring it to this state level. The second issue is the state level committee, in reading the bill, would only meet once a month. The process of getting through the complete design, the permitting, having a contractor on board, and getting through and ready for the summer season, because we have a very short window to do major remodels in schools. There's no option come September. We have to put those children somewhere. So we feel that going through these findings, going through the public hearing, and by the way, interestingly enough, in the 15 times we did it in the last 4 years, we had no one show up to the public hearings doing all the appropriate notices. At the close of the project, we also do a complete review and accounting back to the elected board. Again, no one showed up and had interest in the outcome of the process. It's been said a couple of times of this is an exception to the rules. It was intended for emergencies. It's very clearly outlined in statute as being an alternative. And being an alternative, you could use it on every project if you so chose. It is not an exception or an emergency. It is an alternative. And it has its places, and it has its places where it doesn't fit. I think it's also important to know that in doing, particularly CMGC, we haven't talked about design build or energy saving performance or maybe some other models, but in doing CMGC, the only thing that you're agreeing to is the general contractor's fee when you sign them up for doing the project. All of the rest of the work is competitively bid, just like it is in a normal invitation to bid process. And this is required in the Oregon attorney's model rules, which is what Beaverton School District uses for its purchasing rules. So there's an awful lot of protection there. I'm not sure what we gain by adding yet again another layer. Senator Starr brought up the point of 772, which you're going to hear next. And just briefly on that, taking our $290 million project of the last 4 years, and let's say 20% of that went to architectural fees, that's a charge to the district of $232,000. That hurts when you're trying to stretch your construction dollars as far as you can. We're going to be doing a new high school in a couple of years. Whether we will or won't go CMGC is certainly not on the table. That's to the tune of those projects are running about $200 million. That would run us about $160,000. So this is a significant issue to the school districts and to other public agencies. Now, if there's, I think it was asked, if in fact there's issues, there are processes to be followed, and if they aren't being followed, then we should address those. But this seems to be really going too far and creating an awful lot of cost for the local agencies. So I'd be glad to answer any questions. And
questions?
I would add one other thing. If, in fact, an agency wanted to set up an ability to have their selected contractor, the law also includes a pre-qualification process. And that could certainly be abused and come to, if that's in fact the agency's intent. I've worked for a number of agencies in my 30 years, and I haven't found any of them that's their intent, is to pre-select someone.
Mr. Rakowitz.
Yes. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, John Rakowitz with AGC. You're going to hear more testimony today. I would ask, could I speak to both bills now and then I can be out of your way? Is that work for you, or should I not do that? I can speak to either way, whatever the pleasure of the chair of the committee is.
Chairwoman, I'm going to open on the parallel open on Senate Bill 772.
Okay. Thank you. Within AGC's membership, we have opinions all over the map on the so-called alternative CMGC bidding process. And the intense interests that you have seen and will continue to see today exist within my organization. And I think it's pretty simple why. We've dropped 40,000 jobs since 2007. The industry's in complete collapse. There's over a 35% unemployment rate. There's no doubt this industry is hurting, and hurting as badly as any sector in this state. What is done for the contractors that are still in business, what they've done to stay open, is things like multiple rounds of layoffs, common practice. Bidding at cost has become more and more common practice. In fact, there are public agencies quite pleased that they're coming in at cost with no profit. Obviously, that's not a sustainable practice. You can't stay in business that way. You have to cover your overhead, and then you hope maybe there's a profit. Contractors are traveling to Montana, Wyoming, any place in the world where they might find work. Bottom line, the industry is hurting, and I think that has increased the interest and the intensity of this discussion. Now, to the substance of the matter, I want to make a couple of clarifications. First of all, I think it's really important to note for the committee that the U of O, the university system, is not required by Oregon law to operate under the model contracting rules that the rest of all public agencies are. I have no idea what AGC did in 1997. I was living a different life. All I can tell you is before this committee in 2009, we attempted to run a bill that would have brought the university system back under the model contracting laws, like every other agency. We didn't get very far with that bill. We sat down afterwards, had some good discussions, and we'll continue to have discussions that will ensure that the university system operates in a way that is fair, open, competitive, and in some way resembles the basic public contracting law. And I think it's important to point out that we as AGC, and I think most people in the room today will testify, know, understand, and support that the lowest responsible bidder wins the contract, and that is the basic law. I respectfully disagree with the gentleman that testified just before me. There are exceptions to general rule. It's most commonly called CMGC. We believe at AGC that is the exception. We believe there are good reasons, but they are special, they are limited, and in the testimony that I've handed out today, I think you can see a couple of examples. In the interest of time, I'm not going to call it all out. I submitted this testimony on the behalf of Tom Girding from Corvallis, general contractor there. He's a member of my executive committee, of my board. And in 1998, the interesting part about this, the last time he testified in the Oregon Senate, he violently opposed CMGC. Today, he no longer opposes CMGC. He believes it has a place, just like it has a place in the private sector. And his major point is we do this all the time for our private business and clients. It only makes sense that the overall public benefit from this process in particular circumstances. For all of these reasons, I think this boils down to something pretty simple. I and our organization do not believe that the concept of alternative public contracting is the problem. Do we believe that there is a misuse and overuse? Yes. I think you've heard it today. That's why there are bills both in the House and before you today. Given that we recognize there are all kinds of issues here, our position on these bills are going to be driven by that recognition, number one, and number two, our basic plea to the 2011 session. Please do no further harm to our industry than the economy has already done. This industry is in deep trouble. So, for all those reasons, we do not support Senate Bill 581. We believe basically that it would lead to unintended consequences, one of them of which could be significant delays. We also think that it would be prudent, it's just not prudent at this point to establish a super board that every single public contracting agency would have to go through. We think there's more thinking to be done before a major policy shift like that is called for. For the same reasons, though, we do believe and support Senate Bill 772. And it's similar to House Bill 3415, which we did earlier this month in a House committee support and concept. We like the idea of proposed random audits. We think it sheds some light on what all is going on here and perhaps get some facts underneath the situation, some data. And too much of what we hear, and even within our own association, is all based on anecdotal information. We have no facts. We believe that random audits would begin generating that sort of factual information and avoid just creating policy of significance without knowing what the implications could be. Now, having said that, we would strongly recommend that Senate Bill 772 be amended in a couple of ways. First, we would propose that the bill direct the Secretary of State's office to contract for random audits with companies with construction and public contracting expertise. We think it's important that these audits are going to be done. They need to be done by people that know the industry and the public contracting process. Secondly, we think the implementation date for 772 needs to be longer, not an emergency date. What we believe that would allow for is the group that I will refer to as the Public Contracting Coalition, not an AGC group, but a group that AGC has supported and has it was the group that in 2003 delivered the rewrite of 279, the Oregon's Public Contracting Code that was approved by the 2003 legislature. We propose that a group like this reconvene with all the stakeholders, and that includes contractors, all sizes and shapes. It includes public contracting agencies, and it includes the building trades. In other words, anybody with a stake in how Oregon contracts its construction, its public works construction. We believe this group has the kind of expertise that can utilize and understand the results of random audits, potentially produce solutions, and or certainly an understanding for the legislature going forward about what public policies might be worth changing. I would include a refresh, a look at the public, at the model contracting laws and how they apply or don't apply, or what changes might need to be done there. So in closing, I guess what we're asking the committee to consider is to take initial steps, do it carefully. These are complex issues. Before moving ahead with major modifications, and that's why we would support 772 with the suggested amendments. I would be happy to answer any questions. The only other comment I guess I do want to make is, as Senator Whitsitt underscored earlier, there are big issues here. Nobody believes there's not. Within our own organization, we've spent months since about last May discussing CMGC. We just believe that it's big policy at stake here, that we need to go prudently, we need to get some facts, and we need to do it with all the stakeholders involved. And so, therefore, that's our position on both bills. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Gerard?
The question I have is on 772, mm-hmm. the amount of money, 0.1% for mm-hmm. a contract. If you're talking, you know, $100,000 or $1 million, that probably isn't that significant. But some of these contracts might be $100 million or more, and all of a sudden you're talking real money. So, do you guys have you taken a position on the 0.1%? Personally, I would think that you would want that capped.
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, we have not taken a position. We're hoping that the fiscal or whatever will produce what that actual number is. I'm not sure what that number is. We believe this bill needs some work. We would be happy to engage in a discussion about capping it. The reason that we support the notion of random audits as opposed to auditing everything in the world has to do with cost, has to do with the kind of issue that you raised. So we're wide open on that. I will add that we have been working closely with co-chair Holvey at the other end of the building, that he has got a similar bill to this. We've raised those issues as well with him and the ones that I just spoke to, the amendments I spoke to. So I think the bill needs some work. That would be one element, and we would be happy to work with anybody on that, because we don't think we need to spend, you know, an untoward amount of money on this, but we do think the idea of having data, having audits of what's going on out there is a good public policy.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Rick Thomas, Mike Ellison, and Brian Smith.
Good morning. Good afternoon, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Rick Thomas, representing the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon and the Associated Builders and Contractors Pacific Northwest Chapter. By and large, our organizations support the concept of alternative contracting means and the availability of those, whether it's CMGC is the prevalent tool in that. Several members who do work on projects like that of varying sizes and scopes. However, we do recognize that there are, as Mr. Rakowitz said, some issues that probably do need to be cleaned up in terms of, you know, what constitutes an emergency, different aspects of the CMGC process that contractors have seen over time, expressed some concerns in needing to address. And since we're, I guess, I'll kind of jump back and forth since we're, I believe, under a public hearing on both bills presently. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, you know, our contractors over the past couple of years have had some rather, you know, deep conversations. We've also had some conversations with AGC before the session in talking about these, the House side as well. And, you know, this may be an issue that ultimately needs some further study, something that goes into whether it's a work group during the interim or whatever that may be. Mr. Rakowitz mentioned the Public Contracting Coalition. The one thing I would recommend or encourage is that any of those conversations that take place, that we'd also, you know, like to engage the legislators in that process, because this is a fairly, you know, complex issue and something that even contractors spent months and even years discussing have different opinions and views on, that we would want to welcome that in that process. But, you know, again, I think the interest, whether it's a front-end approach as Senate Bill 581 or a back-end approach in what's in Senate Bill 772, it's that, you know, we need to find some ways that we kind of tighten up things, you know, rein in some of the situations where, you know, it's emergency being, you know, overutilized, or whether it's requirements in contracts that aren't necessarily maybe relevant to the type of project that it is, so that we do keep a broad opportunity for contractors participate and bid on the projects that are financed with their own tax dollars.
Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, Michael Eisen with the Association of Oregon Counties. Many of the points have been made, so I'll speak pretty briefly. We thank Senator Whitsitt for bringing forward Senate Bill 581. However, we do have some issues with that. I believe it takes away local control and adds some administrative burdens and hurdles that would cause some problems, specifically the time delays. Counties currently do allow and sometimes employ alternative contracting procurement methods such as design build or CMGC, but can only be used after they go through a full-blown public hearings process, going through local contract review board. This process alone usually adds 3 to 4 weeks to the procurement process, and adding another layer would probably add considerably more time and cost. Often these alternative contracting methods are used primarily to save time for such things as repairs following a natural disaster, because the alternative contracting method would save months or perhaps even years to the delivery schedule. The local contract review board right now weighs those considerations, makes a determination that it's in the public's interest. This additional layer may be counter to the public's needs. In addition, I'd add 279C355 already requires a report back to the contract review board following the completion of the project to compare the costs, actual costs versus the estimates, and what was sort of learned throughout the process. And then while we're on Senate Bill 772, we share some of Mr. Rakowitz's thoughts. If there are issues that need to be looked at, we'd be happy to participate in a group looking at whether any additional audits are needed. We haven't heard a lot of complaints about counties abusing the alternative processes, but if there are issues, we're certainly willing to be a part of that. We definitely have problems with the 0.1%, as was said. If you start getting into Selwood Bridge type projects or bigger projects than that, we're talking about serious money for audits. And then the bill only talks about random audits, so, you know, we're not sure what we would be buying under the language of the bill. With that, I'll close.
Thank you. Cool.
Chair Beyer,
Senators, my name is Brian Smith. I'm the purchasing manager with Multnomah County, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify here today. I'm testifying against both these bills, and I'd like to talk to you a little bit about the my experience at the local level with these. Senate Bill 581, with the addition of, another bureaucratic review at the state level, which I don't think adds value and diminishes the role of the local public contract review boards. The state law allows Multnomah County Board to act as our public contract review board and publicly make the determination as to whether or not we can conduct an alternate contracting process. I've done several of these. The process is very public, and I assure you that my local contract review board heavily scrutinizes each and every one that we bring request that we bring to them, and it's not something that I advise our departments to go into. It's not appropriate for every project. It certainly is something that should be used as an exception, and only certain projects are complex enough to warrant it. I think the that process is extremely open. It's well documented, and in the last one I was party to, we had two public briefings before there was any action taken by the local contract review board to actually approve the go-ahead to go with a CMGC process. Plenty of opportunities for input. I think going through that large process and then having to repeat it once again on a state level, I don't believe adds any value for the taxpayers. The CMGC is an important tool in the toolbox for gaining best value. And again, like I said, only certain products really warrant using it. And how you use it matters. I'm a bit shocked by some of the things I hear about the state, what goes on at with the university system. It doesn't work like that at the county level. When we're looking at best value, there's a lot of things that we're considering there, and I think this goes to the construction firm's concern about how you use it. In the last CMGC process I was part of, one of the ways that we got best value was we actually gave points for utilization of local firms. What was your utilization of MWSB firms going to be? Did you have any interesting mentor protege or partnerships with local firms? Those kinds of things. We actually asked for them. And you can solicit those kinds of things in the actual solicitation and award points and make selections based on them. Again, that goes to how you use the tool. The other piece that about this is the approval to use the CMGC, both at my own local contract review board and even if you had the state board, the approval to use it is not the same as the actual solicitation and what criteria goes into the solicitation. Those can often be different things. What you're looking at is whether or not the project merits using an alternative process. And so it doesn't necessarily get at the way in which you use it. So that's an important consideration with this. So I guess with that, I respectfully ask this bill, that Senate Bill 581 not move out of the committee. And as an alternate, I would suggest local contracting agencies be exempt from its provisions. Senator Starr, you had also asked for solutions, and I think looking at ways to get local agencies, or all public agencies, to encourage the use and awarding of points for alternate relationships with large firms that are bidding on 20 and 50 and $100 million projects to be working with smaller firms so that they can get the experience. That's how you get it. So I would suggest looking in those kinds of places. On Senate Bill 772, this actually, Multnomah County has 19 special procurements authorized by rule. Five of these would be affected by this bill. Each of these special procurements authorized by rule went through a public process. There's findings on it, and each one, before it's used, is scrutinized by either myself as the purchasing manager or our Board of County Commissioners. These aren't used lightly, and they are... The rules are narrow, and they receive additional scrutiny. Two of them that I'd like to just share with you in terms of what this would actually affect. One is brand name specifications. Our facilities group went through a rigorous process and selected Tremco Roofing as the product for Multnomah County building roofs for both their performance and product guarantees. So we put that out as a specification whenever we do a roofing project. And
Senator Starr?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to interrupt. Mm-hmm. The question I have is, as somebody who operates in this world, do you ever go back and look at a project that was a CMGC project and test whether you could have gotten the deal better if you'd gone maybe the least cost bidding route? Is there any way to go in and to check to see that the taxpayer is actually getting the best bang for their buck?
In absolute way, the only way you would do that is to bid it out. The statute, though, does require that at the end of a CMGC project, we go back to the contract review board and make a report to say how things came out based on what we were predicting.
But you'd really never know whether you would have got it cheaper another way. All you know is whether you were satisfied with the process.
Senator Beyer, you're correct, and yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen. Mm-hmm. Let's see, I'm running out of time here, so I'm going to Mark Matthews and Dan Bates, is it? Mm. And apparently Mr. Landau as well. And gentlemen, I apologize, but if I could ask you to kind of summarize your points quickly, that would be helpful. If you need more time, you need more time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landau, representing the Special Districts Association of Oregon. Our association represents approximately 900 special districts across the state of Oregon. Very briefly, on Senate Bill 581, SDO does oppose it for many of the reasons that you've already heard. One of the reasons that hasn't been raised at this point, however, is that the bill appears to apply to projects already completed. And by having the board review completed projects already, we have some concerns that some legal issues may arise as a result of a board review and a decision that may be adverse, that maybe you shouldn't have used this process. On Senate Bill 772, you know, in some cases, CMGC may be used inappropriately, and our members, having very small members across the state of Oregon, are less sophisticated in some instances and may have made a mistake. We want to know about that, and for that reason we're open to 772, although we are concerned about the 0.1% provision. We would enjoy to have the conversation and have the opportunity to teach our members when this process is the appropriate process to use. Nevertheless, our members do follow the statute in holding hearings, findings, so on and so forth, and so we're certainly open to furthering this conversation if the committee chooses to move this bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, Dan Bates, Thornwind Partners, representing National Association of Minority Contractors. In the interest of time, I'm going to turn it over to the president of the association.
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, Mark Matthews, president of the National Association of Minority Contractors. We oppose this bill. We think it's not a very good bill. The reason we have 65 members of the minority firms in the state of Oregon, and not using GMC, CMGC would not allow us as minority contractors to participate in getting work and being able to help be qualified in the future. Under the contractors.
Now, why is that, as opposed to being able to bid on them?
I figured that question was coming up. As you know, we always have a hard time as minority contractors to get work as it is, and not having the opportunity to work under a CMGC to develop our businesses to become larger contractors, we'll have no opportunities to do so. So therefore, having that in place makes it easy for us to do so.
Questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks.
Jerry.
Sure.
You're not going to go through the whole book again.
No, I just wanted you guys to all see this, is that there's actually case studies now that Dr. Williams from Integrative Partners actually did a study on the Beaverton School Districts. Jerry Valencia and Eugene, Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Byers and Senators. First and foremost, I think one of the issues I need to bring out first, I'm not a lobbyist. I can, you know, I'm not here, I'm not getting paid, and it's taken a lot of time away from my business. My phone's been burning up off the hook today so that I could be here. But the issue is very, very important. The issue on the CMGC was the intent of the law was for emergency processes, not supposed to be the rule. And everybody here has said, you know, point on point, that there is an issue. Let's just kick the can down the road a little bit more and talk about it and not actually resolve any issues. The fact of the matter is, according to the Beaverton study by Dr. Williams of the Innovative Partnerships, the CMGC process, when it was neck and neck on a project in Beaverton, two high schools, it came out that the CMGC process in 2009 was actually 11% more expensive, and they both finished on time. Both products met the qualifications according to Beaverton, and both, you know, according to Dr. Williams, that he could not find any substantial savings, which according to the OAR 137049 0600 says there has to be substantial cost savings. What I introduced today into record is these case studies that said that Dr. Williams did 410 studies of projects here in Oregon, that none of them actually came out to say that we save the taxpayers any money. The integral part of the CMGC process is it creates a team. The problem with this team effort is it forgets one important part of this team. That's the Oregon taxpayer. We have over $4 billion of capital improvements in the state of Oregon. According to the first study that was done by Dr. Williams in Beaverton, at 11%, if we go back to 10% and not use today's, you know, today's history of being about 20 to 30% under cost, that's $400 million of overcharge. This is the only process that says we actually have contracts according to guaranteed maximum price. That's the issue that I have with at first, because of the fact of the matter is, nowhere in capitalism do we ever say, you know what, it doesn't matter what you can do out there in the open market. It doesn't matter that this is, you know, a capitalistic society. Those that can do it better, cheaper, can get that job. What it's turning out to be is an interview process and saying, listen, you're tall, you're short, you're ugly, you're out. The fact of the matter is, if we go $400 million of cost savings that we just threw out the window to a bunch of GCs that have better-looking guys than me up there interviewing for projects at the University of Oregon, Oregon State, and then now all these public contracting agencies like Manoma, like Lane County, like LCC that are not exempt from normal OSR 279, all of a sudden everybody falls under OSR 279C335 and says, oh, we don't have to follow administrative rules because the fact of the matter, someone told us we don't. The fact of the matter is DOJ actually says there are rules and regulations that make that you have to qualify first, and we don't get to that point anymore, and what we get to is a fact that at the end of the day, we forget we have a contractor, we have an owner, which is the public agency, and we have the architect. But everybody forgot about the taxpayer, which is the fourth leg of the table. And that fourth leg of the table is too important in today's economy to keep handing out guaranteed maximum price contracts in the state of Oregon and not saying, you know what, are we getting the best buck, best bang for our buck at the end of the day for everybody? The schools in that the Beaverton School District came up here and said, Salem has put out all of their remodels to hard bid. They're saving massive money. OSU finally sent out an RFP, or not an RFP, a design bid build, and said at the veterinarian clinic and said, our engineer's estimate is $6 million. It came back at 3.35. That's $2.5 million savings, which could go to other contracting needs that need to be done at Oregon State. Do we just tell everybody, too bad, we should have went CMGC? The fact of the matter is that we haven't had anybody come back and say, you know what, after our review, after our audit, after everything else, you know what, maybe we didn't need to go CMGC, and maybe we didn't, you know, stay within our budgets, and maybe we didn't do our due diligence to make sure that we followed the administrative rules according to the DOJ.
I think you got your point across, Chair. Any questions? No? Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to comment on either of these two bills, 581 or 772? Very quickly.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, Scott Winkles representing the League of Oregon Cities. I won't repeat any of the testimony that you've already heard, but League is opposed to both 772 in its current form and 581. To Senator Girard's point on the fiscal impact, we do have some preliminary numbers on how much this would bring in. Right now, we're looking at a single project in the city of Springfield would bring in $7,200. That was a sewer rehab done under the alternative bid method. City of Hillsboro for a single project was $16,000, and the City of Portland's cumulative contribution to this annually would be approximately $280,000. So the amount of money, 0.1%, is going to bring in would be quite significant, and I would submit more than the auditing would require.
Thank you, Scott. Questions to Scott? Thank you. Sorry for overlooking on the other list. All right. Anybody else? Introduce in the record.
Several pieces of written testimony. One from a director at the Secretary of State's Audit Division, just informational, and then two from Diane Lancaster, one on each bill from DAS.
Thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bills 581 and Senate Bill 772. I'm running out of time. Let me ask this. I know there's some people here for Senate Bill 507. For those who are coming here who aren't here every day, like Bill, would you like to testify today and get it over with? You would. Okay, so I'm going to open on Senate Bill 507, and those from out of town who want to testify, come on up. I can do three at a time. I would ask that you make it as quick as you can and get your points across.
I'll speak quickly. My name is Jim Straub, for the record. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Rental Housing Association. We're one of the largest landlord trade groups in the state of Oregon. In fact, the Oregon Rental Housing Association represents rental property owners in the majority of Oregon counties, with over 3,500 landlord members and 65,000 rental units. Additionally, I've been a property manager in Lake County here for over 20 years, so I feel confident representing the interests of Oregon rental property owners. Senate Bill 507 would impose a requirement that new construction or rehabilitation of multifamily housing or housing that is owned by a landlord with 15 or more dwelling units include television antenna systems. It would amend the habitability provision of the Oregon Landlord-Tenant Act, or S-90, and a violation would be subject to a civil penalty not to exceed $5,000. Changes to RS-90 under the Senate bill would be grossly unfair and burdensome to landlords and would be inconsistent with Oregon landlord-tenant law as it now stands. Furthermore, it would entirely alter the fundamental nature of the purpose and concept of habitability under Oregon law. First, with regard to the issue of consistency and fairness, television reception is an entire voluntary utility that is obtained simply for the pleasure of the tenants. While Oregon law requires landlords to assume the burden of the delivery of essential services such as water and electricity, nowhere in landlord-tenant law is a property owner required to provide voluntary services such as telephone or internet. Why should the delivery of a non-essential service such as television be treated any differently? Landlords should not be required to provide voluntary non-essential services to their properties. This requirement places an unfair financial burden on landlords that is inconsistent with current landlord-tenant law regarding other utilities. With regard to habitability, the adoption of Senate Bill 507 would open a Pandora's box in this portion of landlord-tenant law. The concept of habitability in Oregon law has always focused strictly and entirely on two things, the safety and security of tenants and the safety and care of rental properties. ORS 90.320, the habitability provision of landlord tenant law includes such things as effective weather and waterproofing, operable plumbing facilities, safe water supply, operable sewage disposal system, adequate heating facilities, safe and sufficient electrical wiring and equipment, buildings and grounds that are free from garbage, debris, and rodents, safety from fire hazards such as smoke alarms and carbon monoxide detectors, secure locks for doors and windows. It exists, in other words, to ensure that tenants live in a secure, healthy housing environment, and the rental unit itself is properly maintained to ensure this. Habitability has absolutely nothing to do with the delivery of a television signal that exists simply for the pleasure of the tenants, and to add that category to the legal definition of habitability will fundamentally change the entire definition, not simply one provision of the word. Under this line of logic, anything could be added as a habitability concern, surely. We hope that is not the legislature's intent. For these reasons, we ask that you remove Senate Bill 507 from your consideration.
Thank you.
I spoke fast enough.
Thank you very much.
Hi, for the record, I'm Bill Johnstone. I'm the president and CEO of the Oregon Association of Broadcasters and Chairman Beyer Committee. I'm here in support of Senate Bill 507 for a number of different reasons, one of which is that renter tenants today are required to watch cable or satellite, apparently, because in many areas of our state, building construction and the distance of the construction from the television station purely does not allow them to receive free over-the-air television. And with the cost of cable and satellite going up, there needs to be a change, and this particular bill would help bring about that particular change. The other one thing I want to touch on is that emergency signals, emergency information, such as an Amber Alert. Any of those in the room or in the committee that are parents, an Amber Alert is not heard over cable or satellite. It's heard over local television. And without this bill, anyone in those homes would not have access to that Amber Alert. It also would not have access to emergency management or emergency information, such as, and I believe one of my friends will testify this, but to the tsunami or to that warning or to the tornado that hit out here in Marion County. So with that, I would respectfully ask that you would support this bill because it means an awful lot to a great many people. Thank you.
Bill.
Senator Beyer and other members of the committee still here. My name is Larry Southall. I'm a resident of McMinnville in Yamhill County, and I'm a small-time landlord in Oregon. I have one rental property in Yamhill County and one rental property in Multnomah County. I am not a member of any statewide or otherwise landlord association, so I'm independent, and I'm here to speak for myself and possibly express the sentiment of a lot of other people like me, thousands of other small-time landlords in Oregon. I have several issues with this bill. First of all, this bill was not brought by any tenant or any tenant's organization. It was brought by Northwest Television, LLC, which operates a small local television station out of Dallas, Oregon. And Northwest Television LLC, would like every landlord in the state who meets the criteria of the bill to install a local access antenna system and wire it into all their units. And the obvious advantage to Northwest Television LLC is that they have more people they can claim they are exposed to and can get better revenue in terms of advertising dollars. I can't understand how the state would require that I subsidize their business. That's my primary concern. Going from there, the habitability issue is very serious. Raising television or antenna television to the level of habitability for landlords is a severe problem. Habitability, I guess, counterclaims within an eviction action are the way that a renter's attorney can really deal a blow to a very valid eviction for non-payment of rent. And it winds up, you know, often costing a landlord a lot of money. You know, I think myself and most other small landlords throughout Oregon would not want to subsidize this system. We would like the local television stations to pay their own way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Gentlemen?
I had a quick comment, if I could reply, to the emergency management system. I was trained as a Boy Scout growing up, and we were always taught to keep a battery-operated radio for emergency situations. I would humbly submit that perhaps that be an alternative than to forcing landlords to construct and maintain a TV antenna system.
You're not suggesting that landlords supply radios.
Senator Byer. Senator
Thank
Byer,
you, gentlemen.
Committee,
Thank
could
you.
If I could reply.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, we also have battery-operated televisions that would not operate unless we had an antenna to receive them.
Okay, thank you. And who else is here today and won't be here tomorrow?
Hi.
Hi. Come on down. Must be Chris.
Yes, Chairman Byer. The members of the committee. I'm the state emergency chair of
the record, please.
Oh, my name is Chris Murray. I'm in Eugene, Oregon. I'm the current chair of the State Emergency Communications Committee. I'm the liaison person between all public safety and all broadcasting radio and television stations in the state. We protect the public by informing them of events that threaten their life, health, and property. Over the air provides not only emergency alert information, but follow-up information on various events. As an example, we had a tsunami event that just happened last week or a couple of weeks ago. Once the emergency alert goes out, it's the local television stations that provide follow-up information to tell them when the wave is coming, when to expect, where the safety zones are, and to continue that information after the initial alert is issued. When we had that event, it was the local television stations that continued coverage. When disaster looms, it's the broadcasters that the public relies on for information as to what they should do. Cable channels do not necessarily relay these alerts. Dish providers provide new alerts. Your local broadcasters are your first responders in the times of disasters. Rabbit Ears will work in Eugene, and they'll work in Portland. But for the remaining markets of the state of Oregon, they won't work. You need to have an outdoor antenna to pick them up. Many of the markets that we have in this state rely on low-power transmitters in order to get the signals out. If you're living in Albany, or if you're living in Salem, you're having to pull your TV signals in from Portland or from Eugene, a considerable distance. The signals just aren't strong enough for Rabbit Ears. The construction of multiple unit apartment buildings, three storage or larger, are now required to use metal studs in their construction. This completely wipes out television reception. I support this bill to allow renters to receive over-the-air television. When a tornado touched down in Vancouver, just north of Portland, and in Marion County, we had incomplete coverage. It was the over-the-air broadcasters that informed the public of impending disaster. We had an Amber Alert in Sweet Home once. It was an 11-year-old who picked up the broadcast on public television off a translator, a low-power translator, that he was able to receive that signal. I urge the committee to support this bill and help broadcasting continue their message and their mission to partner with public safety and save the lives of our citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. Ken, Cindy, and Andrea, I'm going to carry this over until tomorrow since you're in the building every day, and we'll take your testimony then. Thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 5. Bill 7 and carry, well, excuse me, I'm going to carry it over. And that's it. We are
I'm going to carry these two over.
Oh, I'm sorry. And also we'll carry over Senate Bill 438 and Senate Bill 518. Thank you very much. We are adjourned.